very much for your understanding. We are back. I would like to again request the minister to provide responses to the questions that were asked, the minister and his team. Over to you, Honourable Minister.
Thank you very much, but I noticed that the people who asked some of the questions are not here, so I don't know. But I hope they won't come and ask the same questions. The Deputy Minister was supposed to answer some of the questions, but he's not here. Let me start with the well, the tax collection issue is going to address the growth trajectory issue. Really, the under normal circumstances, you'll ask yourself the question, where is this growth going to come from? Is it going to come from tourism? Is it going to come from both agricultural, manufacturing, exports, which are including even mining? So where is this growth going to come from? So the Treasury economists made some calculations which say if we get the tourism issues sorted out, like we've discussed before, that could add X percentage points to growth. I think I went through that in the medium-term budget statement, if you recall. If we sort out the industrial parks, that could contribute so much. Sort out agriculture, so much. If you bear in mind, for example, in agriculture, that last year agriculture contributed some $11 billion of exports, so that's clearly an area that we must come back and focus on. All kinds of regulatory bottlenecks and so on. So the multi-pronged approach, as we indicated in the medium-term budget statement, in terms of those package of measures that will help the growth process. Infrastructure investment, very key to the growth process. That's why we are allocating, we're making allocation for the infrastructure investment fund, and we want to try and learn from wastage by locating capacity and capability in the DBSA, but bring together the Presidential Infrastructure Commission work, and together with any funding that we are going to source from the New Development Bank. So a number of areas will contribute to the growth trajectory. Civil service numbers, it is clear that without negotiating the detail with the public service workers, we might not be able to go anywhere. But I understand that the willingness is there amongst a significant number of them to go on pension. Of course, in things like this, one has to tread carefully that you don't end up losing some of the more efficient and good civil servants, because normally the good ones tend to leave and the bad ones tend to stay. I'm not making any comment about Parliament at all. I'm just saying that that's the experience globally. That's why I'm not a member of parliament now. So, under normal circumstances, what you do is the DGs should know their people. So they should be able to say, whenever you can't go, please stay. But Eunice should go because it's troublesome. That's how you retain some of the good people. I went through this exercise in the probably given your behavior this morning, maybe I went through the same exercise in the Department of Labor and also in the South African Reserve Bank, and we were able to reduce numbers quite significantly, but retain the people that we wanted to stay. So one has to be very careful about how you go about it. I'm not going into more details about this. The minister has probably issued the circular already by now, so some of the detail will be in the circular that she's going to issue. The small business support. I think that we are probably beginning to create too many institutions, and this might be a problem. So I've begun to ask myself the question whether it was such a wise thing to have allowed the Small Business Development Corporation to die. That's probably not a wise thing. So a little bit more thinking is required on how to have a clearly targeted, better managed funding model for small businesses. But we can't wait until we create the most appropriate structures. That's why the allocation to the small business enterprise. What is it? The institution. Small Business Enterprise Funding.
Small Enterprise Finance.
Small Enterprise, yes. So I think that's why the allocation to that. I hope we're able to get some of the money back. And I think we talk quite a lot about small businesses, you're right. But when it comes to the actual directed, targeted funding, we tend to be a bit weak there. But we'll bear your point in mind as we implement these programs. The salary freezes, they do affect cabinet ministers, yes. And and are beginning to complain because they've not had an adjustment, I think, for a number of years now. And of course, there's a danger in this salary freezes because you're creating a structural weakness. When 1 year to come and make good the gap, you might find that the jump might be a bit high and it will attract people. Maybe do it halfway through the next parliament. I think anybody in the system who earns 1.5 and above will experience that wage freeze. So I've written to all the ministers to say to them that they must carry the same message to the entities which report to them. For example, CSIR or whatever. And I hope they've gone ahead to partly symbolic that we're in a difficult situation, so let's tighten our belts. So that, you know, society out there can see that we're doing something, even though they still think that ministers are overpaid, so on. Well, coming back from the private sector, I was shocked to find how little ministers get paid. I was really shocked. Well, the MPs, I was looking at myself, and when I noticed that the Minister of Finance also gets paid the same, when with the Minister of Sports, I was shocked. I said, "Wouldn't do such a thing in the private sector." Okay. As a privatization, do you want it? I can give it to you for 1 rand. I can give it to you for 1 rand. The reason why it's so difficult to privatize SAA is structural. Nobody wants to buy it. It has got so much debt. It's not functioning optimally. From what the briefing I have from the Department of Public Enterprises is that it really doesn't have many assets, actually. I think the Minister of Public Enterprises is trying his best to working with the ESCOM Board of Directors and Executive to see if they can find an equity partner, but it's very difficult to find an equity partner. I have a solution for SAA, but I've been told not to speak about it anymore, but I have a solution for SAA. You see, for example, if SAA has about just close on 3% shareholding in Air Link, Air Link is profitable. It's making money. I'm sure you've seen at the airport, they're beginning to buy larger aircraft. And they have some regional routes, Swaziland, Gaborone, Livingston, and so on. That poses an interesting conceptual challenge, which probably gives you a solution in the process to SAA. I can't say much than this, but it gives you something to think about. And for example, I don't think it makes sense to have South African Express side by side with Air Link, with Express being 100% SAA and Air Link 3% SAA. You all use the same booking system for your flight. Really, truly speaking, let's wake up a bit, really. So, I leave that there. The ESCOM issue. I must apologize if the words that we use might be confusing, but actually it means the same thing. And I think probably the best way is the way in which we put it yesterday. That we're talking about dividing ESCOM into three parts. Generation, transmission, and distribution. Now it's correct in English to say you've reconfigured the entity. It's a reconfiguration. Some will say it was one thing, we've unbundled it. But I think the president doesn't like the word unbundle. So having three divisions seems to be a better way. But the generation division will compete with other power generators, whether they are hydro, whether they are renewable energy, whether they are other large generators of power. I think we should be open to that. And I like the way the president puts it. He says that this will avoid us having our eggs in one basket. So if an Eskom generator fails there, why should we all suffer because it's Eskom? What about if we had other competitors? They will continue producing, and if they fail one day, the Eskom generators will be able to continue supply. So you have competition in that market. But I think the point that he has been strong about is the transmission, that will remain as a national grid. But who knows over time what's going to happen. But for now, he has been very strict about that. And on the distribution side, we know what happens. I mean, this municipalities, Eskom, that does it directly. You might find other technologies that might come in. So I think that's what has been talked about. But once that is achieved, we'll have a better sense of the actual cost structure. Where is the bigger problem in the system? And better management. At the moment, Eskom as well is just too big to manage, I think. So that's where we are, but... But we are proceeding from the point that we're not going to wait for the restructuring to be done. Eskom needs assistance now. That's why we're providing the $23 billion over the... per annum over the next 3 years, we'll show about, but that will continue for about 10 years, which will come to around $230 billion or something like that. But for now, I think we wrote in the book $69 billion, which is three year period. But as I said, and I emphasize it again here, wherever the Treasury provides funding from now onwards, we are going to install our people there as well, to be our eyes and ears there. And these things work, by the way. Anybody in the private sector who has been subjected to this thing will tell you that this thing works. I was on the board of PPC when the banks lost patience with us, and for all intents and purposes they took the keys of the company. What did they do? They installed the chief restructuring office. It doesn't mean lack of confidence in the board of directors. The board of directors continues with its function, its supervisory role, but this is operational, working very closely with the chief executive and the chief operations officer. Yes, there can be conflicts between the chief restructuring officer and the CEO, but they are adults, they will have to sort themselves out. There was something about the township economy. Deputy Minister will answer, because he was a mayor, he understands that very well. The rest, Brexit. The immediate benefit for us from Brexit, it's not about companies which were located in England coming to locate in South Africa, but it's on the trade side. So suddenly, I think those of you who are in the trade and industry portfolio should know this. Suddenly, we'll find actually some opportunities for some of our products, particularly wine, directly into the English market. So we no longer have some of the restrictions in competing with French wine in the rest of Europe, but we can send wine directly to the British. So there will be some trade benefits. I personally don't like Brexit. I think they're making a big mistake. But there are some marginal benefits we're going to get there. Let me leave it there, and my colleagues will take on the others. DM, you want to start with the township economy? Thank you very much.
I'm so used to the minister answering all these questions. So as a result, for God to be an aloe in readiness to respond. On the issue of township economy, this is an intervention, as you know, to check stimulation of the economy in a wider sense, ensure that these activities take place where the historically disadvantaged people are. In the stimulus package, this was one of the areas that were intended to be stimulated. But my trick is that I would request the officials to explain the, when I wanted to know why we don't have it exactly here, it appeared that in the MTF, at a particular point in time, the exact figure might come in there. But the other way the money will find way is when you piggyback on the existing what to call program of about that goes to small business enterprise, about 1 billion. But I think the managers will explain that one better when they actually respond. I don't have to explain its benefits. Its benefits are known. To go and to build the infrastructure in the township, for instance, to ride on the minister's words, if you go to Uruleni, for instance, you go to Tembisa, to Togoza, there's something called fabrication laboratory, where kids are kept busy innovating. Boston World Foundation is led worldwide. I think Ekurhuleni is one of the few that are affiliated to that. A lot of ideas do come out of that in the township. Of course, there are innovation hubs, incubation hubs, if you go to Isando, where up-and-coming business are given opportunities to actually build their ideas and be given infrastructure that is available, both from the point of skill and access to IT. It applies not only to that, it also applies to construction and so on. But however, in terms of the exact intervention with regard to finance, I think it's safer to allow the management to articulate those what to call those figures. I hope that was the only word you wanted me to comment on.
Thank you, Minister. Thank you, Deputy Minister. As I said at the beginning, we've got Mampo who's going to touch on all areas that are related to funding, specific funding, and Duncan will talk about the growth stuff. Ian will talk about the fiscal stuff, the framework, and why 23 billion. And then we've got Chris and, to an extent, Mark Keenan from SARS, who will then talk about tax-related matters. There were a number of questions around tax. And then later, Chair, we'll just keep. Maybe let's start with Ian. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Chair. So there have been a lot of questions. Let me try and clarify how the ESCOM numbers appear in the book. So the fundamental is this. There's a lot of uncertainty about the long-term outlook for ESCOM. tremendous uncertainty. There are a lot of people working on this, looking at it, thinking about the numbers. But the fact of the matter is it all depends on what you think the long-run tariff increases are going to be, what kind of growth there's going to be, what is the electricity demand going to be, and how electricity intensive will growth be, what will the structure of the company be like over the next 5 to 10 years. And in a sense, a lot of that work still has to be done. But we had to make a decision in putting together the fiscal framework about what should be said about Eskom. You know, the one extreme is to say nothing and say that work is still underway, they have space under their guarantee. Once that guarantee has been used up, we will present some additional figures. We felt that that would not be credible because we know that Eskom is a major financial risk. It's a major risk to growth and to the public finances, and that well, the severity of the situation, I'm sure, is we've seen with load shedding and other issues coming through in the past few weeks. So on those decisions, we decided we must say something explicit about Eskom, especially around the financing. That's why we've gone with putting these figures into the fiscal framework. The next discussion is, well, how do you do it? What number do you put in? Having spoken to the presidential task team and to a wide range of other interested parties that have been looking at Eskom's numbers for a while, our conclusion is that Eskom needs balance sheet support of around 150 billion rand. If you amortize that over 10 years, you get 23 billion rand per annum, and that's the number that we've penciled into the framework. So it's not exact, but we do know for a fact that Eskom has got severe liquidity pressures coming up over the coming year. We know that we can't allow Eskom to default, and it's clear that they are going to need some support in order to pay off their debt service costs and do capital repayments, and that is what this funding is set aside for. So effectively it's 150 billion of balance sheet support spread out over a decade. Now the question is, can we commit to that? I think that was one of the questions put forward. Can we commit to that? Well, the way we're thinking about it is a lot has to be worked out, both on the financing and the operational reform side. But we know that they are going to require support over the next couple of years, and we've penciled that in. Beyond that, it's going to depend on all of the factors that I've just mentioned, but we felt the prudent thing is to put in some numbers over the next decade, and it's all going to depend on exactly how this reorganization process plays out. You know, the other thing is that in discussions with ratings agencies, one of the key elements that was put to us is that whatever we do, we need to be transparent about it. We also think that this is the most transparent way that we can signal our support to Eskom. How the money will exactly flow is going to also depend on the structure, the new company, and the way in which the divisions are put together. The exact asset and liability mix of each is still to be determined, but of course it's not a situation in which the PICs would be doing a debt-to-equity swap for assets that aren't generating a return. Again, this is all that has to be worked out. These discussions are underway. But ultimately, we're saying that we have to confront this challenge, and we've put some figures into the budget. Over time, these are going to change as we become, as the plan around it becomes clearer. And it is clear that Eskom needs support right now in order to keep the lights on and continue with its current work.
Thank you. There was a question, and Mark will come in on illicit cigarette trading and the impact thereof and outflows. And you can come to that, Mark.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe just to touch on a few things, because there's been a few questions, I could just deal with it. But in terms of the illicit trade, I would like to just refer the members. There's two notes, one in Annex C, which deals with specifically in terms of the customs space where advance payments are paid for goods to come into the country in the future. It's on page 137 of the budget review. And it deals with an amendment that we're going to be considering with regards to customs and excise for us to share information with the banks to enable us to actually reconcile the advance payments with the money that is coming going out with the goods coming in. Because we do believe, from the information that we're receiving with from the banks, that this is one of the areas that is being utilized for illicit financial flows. People place an order and the goods never arrive. And if we can reconcile that, we do believe that we can address that. There is also an amendment which Chris could maybe just touch on from a policy point of view in Chapter 4. But Chair and Minister, if it's all right, I'll respond to the other SARS matters because there's a number of questions pertaining to SARS. There was a question with regards to the large business centre that was shut down and put back together. I think that is dealt with extensively by Judge Nugent in his commission, and the Minister did allude to the fact that that is being established formally with from 1 April. The illicit economy unit, which deals with illicit financial flows, including textiles and any other good, whether where it comes in illicitly, has been re-established. We've got over 50 people that are operating in that unit. While I will not discuss taxpayer affairs, you are aware of what was in the media this week. That will become the norm. We cannot sit with a debt book of around 150 billion where people just actually ignore us, for want of a better word, and simply don't pay. So that will become the norm. We intend to take action to collect. What have we done to strengthen our organization? Since MTBPS, I think a big focus then was the issue of refunds. Refunds peaked at in excess of 40 billion rand in terms of VAT. I'll just focus on that because there was a lot of discussion. As of yesterday, that reduced to 23.7 billion on our VAT credit book. With only 8 billion, that is work that we can actually do. So really, we're on top of this now. We are refunding, if you read in the budget review, around 22 point something billion a month. We really have got on top of this, and we intend to continue to ensure that we are on top of that. Yes, there's other things we are doing in various areas, including looking to get new staff in, and specifically with skills. Transfer pricing is one of the areas that we have to get skills in. We haven't managed or succeeded as well as we would like at this stage, but we are committed to do that. We do believe we're moving forward, which is the important thing. We're not moving backwards. Yes, revenue has not followed, which the Minister keeps reminding me that we need to get. We have to collect the revenues. While we've got a debt book of around 150 billion, we've got a job to do, and we're going to do it.
I mentioned earlier that there's also the possibility, honorable members, that because people have seen that they're now getting the VAT refund, even those who were discouraged before now are starting to apply because they can see this thing is happening. It's not a bad thing on its own. It's good because it means that money is flowing back as well into people's pockets, into the economy, so that's positive. And it's good because it shows, again, a returning confidence into the SARS system, which is very good for tax collection. Thank you.
Thank you that you have shorted to the point. We're running out of time. We were given up till 3 o'clock to finish our business. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I'll be short. There were a few questions about the growth forecast and potential GDP and so on. So just to speak to those, and then on the policy certainty question and the small business financing. The member is correct. Our forecast has been revised downwards in the budget this year relative to the MTBPS, but also in the last few years. And I think the important point to make there is that so has everyone else's. So there's a range of institutions like ourselves, banks, international multilateral agencies, and so on, university academics, they all produce forecasts, and all of them have had to revise their forecasts down consistently over the last few years. What's important to note about the Treasury forecast is that independent research has looked at our forecasts relative to those of other institutions,
and has found that over the last few years our performance has been better than most of those other institutions. And the way they assess better is that we've had to revise our forecast down less than most of those other institutions. And the reasons forecasts get revised down is because forecasts are based on assumptions, and those assumptions change. So just to give an example to the members, we've had to revise our household consumption assumption down relative to the MTBPS. The reason we've had to do that is because what we expected around how wages were going to grow came out lower than what everyone expected, and because wage growth is lower and because employment growth is lower, that means households have less money to spend, and so we have to revise our household consumption number down. Other assumptions can go up. Our commodity price assumption, for example, has gone up. Our oil price since October has come down. In October, we weren't quite sure what was going to happen with Eskom. Now we know we have Eskom built into the fiscal framework, and because of what's happened to Eskom, we've had to change our investment assumption, because providing fiscal support to Eskom crowds out private investment, so we had to change that assumption, and we had to change our sovereign risk premium assumption. And I think at some point, I think we've said this before, it might be useful for us to just take the members through the forecast process and how it works. What we have introduced in the budget this year, just to speak to the issue around potential GDP, we have introduced a range of four scenarios around our forecast. So we have a baseline forecast. We've reported on this before, but this year we put it up front in Chapter 2. We have our baseline forecast, which we need for the fiscal framework and which Chris needs for the tax framework. But we have four scenarios around that. And scenario A speaks to the issue of how do you raise potential GDP growth, and I think the minister spoke to that as well, and what that means for the forecast potentially on the upside. But we also have a downside scenario, and the downside scenario links to a fiscal crisis and what that would mean for growth, for example. And I think it's very important for us to understand that, yes, we have a baseline forecast, but there are a range of scenarios around that forecast. Just very briefly on some of the other issues, where are the areas where we strengthen policy certainty? The feedback we received from the private sector in particular has been that where they've appreciated the policy certainty coming through has been around mining and energy policy in particular. Energy policy in the form of the finalization of the renewable energy bid windows 4 and 4.5, and that's obviously unlocked private investment, which is built into our forecast. And then on the mining policy side, we've had a range of developments, and we could see the impact that that's had on mining investment commitments at the investment conference. Then just finally, very briefly, on the small business financing, and Mampo will talk to this as well, there was a question around shouldn't we be creating support for startups and entrepreneurship through this process? The key difference with the small business financing that's been announced at $1 billion a year that will start flowing this year is that it is a joint fund between the Department of Science and Technology and small business, so it has an innovation component as well, and it particularly will target startups and early businesses in the early phase of their business cycle. And what's critical in terms of the relationship with CIFA's impairment book, yes, CIFA does have a big impairment book, but the part of CIFA's impairment book that performs very well is their wholesale financing part of the book, which is where they use intermediaries to disperse the funding on their behalf and to do the credit checking and so on. And the model that is envisaged for this funding is along similar lines. So it will have an innovation component, it will have a startup component, and the model of disbursement will be one that relies on a wholesale funding model, which is where the impairments have been much, much lower than the rest of their book.
Chairperson, regarding...
Dr. Modiso, you have 2 minutes.
She's the only one to speak in
the office. I see. But it's all right. I know she can do it in 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Over to you.
The 481, that is over the MTEF in terms of the Small Business Enterprise Development Agency. The question on higher education, so the first thing is that the 105 million that is in the book, that is not to fund the announcement made by the president, but it's actually to fund the student accommodation in the different TVET colleges. So it's not part of that, but we have been working with Susan Asana and other task team members to figure out the sustainability of the higher education. Basically, what it will depend on would be how fast we roll it out, who gets included, and if you work around those mechanics, then the ministers will have to decide on which model is sustainable. Do you continue with grant funding? Do you introduce loans? But that work continues, because remember, we were just given, or the policy was announced, we had to implement it, but we have been working with the department and the private sector quite a lot in terms of trying to come up with the sustainable model. I'm not saying that. I'm saying you have policy, you have to implement it, then you work around the modalities of which part of it can become a loan or a grant funding, and what is the mix. Remember that the president only announced up to 350,000, but you still have to decide or figure out how you help the missing middle. We still have to work on that. So that's the work I'm talking about.
Okay, Honourable... Minister, honourable members, I think we've exhausted, the questioning time. But then for all those who still have got questions, may I please request you to write them down and then submit them to the secretariat, who will then redirect that to the department, and the department will respond that in writing. And all the responses will be circulated to members. Thank you very much. I would like to hand over to Honourable...
I'm going to be very brief. Just to alert the Minister, there's nothing to summarise. Just to alert you, Minister. This committee, Finance, we work with four other committees. We're obsessed with illicit financial flows. We feel that far, far more needs to be done, and far, far quicker. It's not just the responsibility of SARS and Treasury. It's a whole lot of departments. We wrote to your predecessors saying we suggest that we can't prescribe that it's consideration by the presidency of an interministerial committee. For the very reasons you spoke this morning about the severe crisis we're in, we need every penny that is due to SARS to get there. And the figures vary from 50 billion to much lower. Even if it's 10 cents, let's get it back. And we really wish you well on this illicit financial flows. Thank you. There's nothing for me to add. We're out of time. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so that when you reach the office, you don't need to...
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.